Hi, I'm Caitlin Prest, and I am here in your ear to tell you about a very incredible new show called Asking For It. Asking For It is a darkly comedic series that follows a queer femme singer whose history of violence finds her no matter how many times she runs away. It has an original soundtrack, and it'll make you laugh, cry, and feel a little bit less alone. Asking For It. Subscribe now.
This is a CBC podcast.
My name is Shams Irfan. I am 24 years old.
Shams. His name means son.
I was born and raised in a very remote village in eastern part of Afghanistan.
In 2014, Shams was just 15 years old and worked at a school that taught English. On a trip to Kabul to buy school supplies, members of the Taliban pulled him off a bus, accused him of being a traitor.
The Taliban started slapping me on the face and calling me infidel. And I became speechless, and I was 100% convinced that I was about to be shot dead.
I'm Aliza Siegel, and this is Storylines. That moment set Shams on a treacherous 8-year journey until he finally landed in Canada, where he vowed to help bring others like himself to safety and found the people who could help him do it. This is the story of that remarkable collaboration between three strangers from vastly different worlds. Shams, a writer and refugee from Afghanistan.
I found sponsors for a number of refugees, but we did not have money. So I reached out to Miriam.
Miriam, a retired Australian academic.
I do see my role as helping with a kind of underground railroad of refugees. What I can do is help with money and make life easier for people. Say yes.
And Stephen, a Canadian refugee advocate.
There was a moment where I was like, who is this person? You are funding what? That's a lot of people.
Three strangers united in a single mission to rescue Hazara refugees from Afghanistan, trapped in Indonesia, and help them begin new lives in Canada. And just a warning, it does include a description of a suicide. Now, back to that bus in 2014. 15-year-old Shams was certain he was about to die at the hands of the Taliban.
They were calling me the servant of Westerners. They were calling me apostate and traitor. I was shaking in fear.
A stranger, a woman seated beside him, stood up and yelled that they were mistaken, that he was her son. She saved his life. Shams knew he could never go home. He went into hiding. His family sent money, and with the help of paid smugglers, he fled from Afghanistan to India to Malaysia. From Malaysia, he sailed by boat to Indonesia. There he hoped to find refugee status and a safe haven. Instead, he spent a year on the streets of Jakarta.
I slept under the tent, and I did not have access to water, to food. I would wash the plates of the vendors who were selling local food on their carts, and at the end of the night, they would give me some food to eat.
It was 2015. He had no choice but to surrender himself to a refugee detention center.
They confiscated all my belongings, my clothes, my cell phone, and they checked all my body and gave me pairs of slippers.
Shams quickly understood that detention meant prison, surrounded by barbed wire and armed guards.
When I walked in the prison, when I walked through those massive, solid iron gates, I found myself among over 300 people detained there.
Most had been there for years.
I was shocked.
Indonesian refugee detention centers were established as holding tanks to prevent asylum seekers from reaching Australia and other countries. Shams slept in a cramped cell on a concrete floor. There was little food or water.
We had only one toilet in the block. For 180 people, we had only one public washroom. There was no running water. We would receive running water for an hour a day. And each person had 5 minutes, sometimes 3 minutes.
Refugees were not allowed to go to school, not allowed to work. Shams taught English to fellow inmates. He smuggled in cell phones for himself and others by bribing guards with sugar. And he wrote with a vengeance.
Writing became my escape.
Shams became increasingly politically active. He fought for refugee rights and organized demonstrations.
For the first time in many years,
in 2017, when a group of Indonesian journalists came to report on conditions inside the camp,
the living conditions of refugees,
Shams spoke openly about the long list of injustices.
So that day, I spoke with these journalists.
Prison authorities were furious.
One of the senior officers of the prison guards grabbed my hand and slapped my face for telling the journalists the truth. He took me to his office. With his friends, they beat me up.
Shams was placed in solitary confinement. He lost track of time.
I thought there was no way to escape. I lost all my hope. I thought I would be in the prison forever. I felt that I don't belong to this world. The level of hopelessness was mounting every day, and I felt that I was left behind.
In September 2018, after more than 3 years in detention, Shams was transferred to the Batam refugee shelter. Conditions were better, but he still wasn't free to come and go as he wished.
It was time for me to go to school and complete my high school, but I was in the prison camp, counting every second.
On his cell phone, Shams scoured the earth for any country that would take him,
and praying for an end to my imprisonment.
He tried Australia and New Zealand, and he used social media to establish contacts with potential sponsors in other countries, including Canada.
My name is Stephen Watt. I work at the University of Toronto, and I have a not-for-profit called Northern Lights Canada.
By day, Stephen Watt works in communications. But since 2016, he has devoted himself to refugees. He connects those hoping to enter Canada with potential Canadian private sponsors. He then guides both parties through the application process.
I was communicating with Stephen on Facebook, on Messenger.
The tone was polite, but with an edge of need. He knew that if he didn't connect with Canadians, he was probably going to be stuck there for another decade.
He didn't know me. He never saw my picture. He never met me.
For a long time, he, like a lot of refugees in Indonesia, was sort of betting on Australia taking them in. And then 2018, I think the realization, as years passed, people there for 5 years by that point, realization started to dawn that it wasn't happening. That was a real low point for refugees, and probably a low point for Shams as well, when refugees realized, I don't think Australia is taking us. I think we're stuck here. And you actually had a whole spate of suicides.
It was around 2 a.m. in the morning. A friend rushed into my room and told me that our friend committed suicide. With bare feet, I walked into the refugee yard. I found my friend hanging from the rope. And I held him up so he could breathe in my arms. But he was so heavy. And a friend brought a knife and he cut the rope. And I fell down together with him.
I think it was kind of a year of awakening in the refugee community that they weren't going anywhere. And it happened to time with this same time that we started getting involved in sponsoring people from Indonesia. So I would like to think that there were some suicides that were averted because there's now a hope of coming to Canada. At least there's a hope. At least there's something.
He encouraged me to continue writing and expose the way that refugees were being treated.
As Shams searched for a sponsor, he wrote and wrote letters to refugee advocates in Australia and around the world, posts on his Facebook page. He wrote for international publications and for The Archipelago, an online literary magazine he co-founded with other refugees in Indonesia. He always used his pseudonym, Irfan Dana. It took 2.5 more years, but finally, a woman in Burlington, Ontario, moved by Shams's story, agreed to sponsor him. In March of 2022, more than 8 years after he arrived in Indonesia, his application was approved.
When the plane was coming to land, I could not believe my eyes that I see Toronto, that I am here. When the Canadian immigration officer stamped my permanent residency paper and told me, "Welcome to Canada," I felt human. I felt I was reborn. And 8 years of detention, 8 years of loneliness, 8 years of hopelessness, and 8 years of physical and mental torment comes to an end. For the first time, like in 8 years, I was not scared of telling my real name, and everybody was now calling me by my name, Shams. Welcome, Shams. That was a beautiful moment. It helped me feel protected there, that I would not be hurt any longer.
We need to take a quick break. Storylines, we'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Caitlin Prest, and I am here in your ear to tell you about a very incredible new show called Asking For It. Asking For It is a darkly comedic series that follows a queer femme singer whose history of violence finds her no matter how many times she runs away. It has an original soundtrack, and it'll make you laugh, cry, and feel a little bit less alone. Asking For It. Subscribe now.
Shams spent his first 10 months in Canada with his sponsor family. He earned a coveted position as a Pen Canada writer-in-residence at Toronto's George Brown College. And he began to advocate, alongside Stephen, on behalf of other refugees hoping to come to Canada.
All I needed now was to form more groups of sponsorships. I talked to a few people in our neighborhood, and they said, "We can sign their application. We can be sponsors, but we don't have money."
Enter Miriam Fain in Australia.
My name's Miriam Fain. I'm a retired English language teacher and academic, and I've been supporting or working with immigrants and refugees all my life, basically. My mother was a Jewish refugee from Germany who came to New Zealand in 1939 with her extended family. And I've known all my life how lucky I am. To me, it goes without saying that we need to support people who are fleeing with their lives. And I feel a compulsion to do what I can to support refugees. So currently I'm
working. In 2021, Miriam's elderly parents died. They left their home in Melbourne to Miriam and her two siblings.
Honestly, at this stage in my life, I don't need the money. And there was really no reason for me to bank this money. I needed to find something worthwhile to do with it. And it was just fortuitous that it was at that moment that I began to find out about the people in Indonesia and became aware that one of the issues in sponsoring people is that people were stuck, that people in Canada were willing to sponsor them, but they were finding it hard to raise all the money. So at some moment I thought, righto, I'll give the money for sponsorships. And that's what I've done.
A three-way partnership was born.
It is kind of weirdly like a three-way romance between, you know, in this case, a gay Canadian, a very young, accomplished Hazara writer, and a Jewish retired professor from Australia.
Why Canada? Because Canada, for better or worse, has been the country that has been most welcoming.
And Canada has a private sponsorship agreement program that allows this to happen.
I'm just checking my spreadsheet. I think I've helped about 190 individuals or families. So I've given a $10,000 to the individuals and $20,000 mostly to the families. The reason I do that is because I don't want to be in the business of judging who's more worthy than others, and I wanted the money to go as far as I could. So I figured the $10,000 Australian was enough to give people a leg on, and I'll run online fundraisers for people to find the balance, but I don't want to contribute it directly myself.
Miriam's generosity is definitely a game changer, because 6 years ago, you could just sort of start a GoFundMe and
raising say, money hey, through online fundraising drives isn't as easy as it used to be.
If it's a big family, we can be talking $60,000, $70,000. Where does that money come from? It can't come from the refugee. That's a rule. So this is where somebody like Miriam Fain is a game changer. I haven't seen a donor ever do what she's done.
It is deeply personal for me, and it always has been. My mother never got over her experience, really, of growing up as a Jewish child in Hitler's Germany and of coming to New Zealand as a 12-year-old. She always felt alienated. And so, you know, in many ways, I have taken on my mother's feeling of responsibility for other people in that situation. There's another factor I want to mention, which is that my own identity as a Jewish person working with Muslim people, and I've been very clear to people that that's my own background, and it's been important to me to establish the commonalities, not the differences. And I also feel a desire to make the world a better place. I was brought up to believe that if you see something bad happen and you stand by and you don't respond to it, then, you know, you are to some degree implicated. And so I feel that what's happening in Indonesia, as an Australian, I feel deeply compromised by the way successive Australian governments have acted over 20 years towards refugees. So it is the personal as political. I'm a child of the 60s.
The money Miriam sends through Shams and Stephen is a fraction of her support. She sends money to many other refugees directly. Some are destined for Canada, Australia, and the United States. Others have found their way to Europe and Turkey.
The requests are often overwhelming. And you know, not everybody's honest. One thing that happens is that everybody's incredibly urgent and the Taliban's going to catch their relatives and kill them if they don't get sponsored immediately, or their mother's got cancer, or this week everybody's sister's been kidnapped by the Taliban. And I'm very careful with those. I think I grapple with the expectations people have and their own anxieties and their desire to project their anxiety onto me. So it's the sort of, you know, you've got to do something today, you've got to do something today, you've got to do something today. And it's very hard regulating that. But most of the people are honest. I know I've been scammed once or twice, but I'm pretty confident the majority of that money has gone to people who need it.
When I send out a note and say, okay, there is another guy, and he has the sponsors, and everything is ready, and we're waiting for money, can you help? She never said no.
As long as I can find the money, and as long as there's someone who wants to get out of Indonesia, I'm happy to help them with that. That's my priority. I'm not setting myself up to be some kind of saint. I like handing out the money. It's a way, as Stephen and I both agree, it's a very good way of making a difference very quickly. So as long as we can, we will.
So much hatred in the world is happening now. So much pain is unfolding in the world. And when I reach out to Miriam and say, this refugee needs money, she says, yes, I will send. I would be shocked. Governments and big organizations with a lot of money do not do what she does.
And Miriam asks only that those she helps send photos of themselves in their new countries. Some who've made it to Australia have come to thank her in person, gifts in hand.
I love a lot of the young refugees in a motherly way, and I feel like I want to protect them, like a sort of mother hen. In Hazara culture, you call people by a title, not by their names. I get called auntie, but mostly I get called mother or mum, and it's lovely. I only have one child. I love being a mother. So being able to extend my mothering to a whole bunch of people who need me is fantastic.
And she relishes the videos that Stephen posts online of new arrivals at Toronto's Pearson Airport.
One of the things I said at the beginning was people said to me, oh, you want to be anonymous, don't you? And when I thought about it, I thought, no, I don't want to be anonymous. It's very important to me that I get to know the people that I'm helping and that they get to know me. So I don't want to be seen as a crazy old lady with too much money. And I don't want to see the refugees as poor, benighted victims. It's important to me that I see them in terms of their capabilities. And that's one of the things I see in Shums, is someone who has developed a strong sense of agency in very, very negative situations. As you can hear, it's very complicated. It's not just a matter of writing a check, writing a check, writing a check. The complications involved are to do with who has the money, who has the agency, who has the voice, who makes the decisions. I'm the one who decides who's worthy. And that's one of the reasons why I enjoy working with people like Shums and Stephen, because they help take that responsibility off me.
I reached out to many organizations and they turned down my request to sponsor my family.
Shams's own siblings and their families fled Afghanistan shortly after the Taliban returned to power in 2021. They have been stuck in limbo in Pakistan since. A local Toronto church agreed to sponsor them, but Shams needed close to $70,000. He hesitated and then approached Miriam.
So when he said to me, do you think you could help my family? And he was very tentative. I said, of course.
She said, you know, you help other people. I want to help you as well.
Their application has now been approved. Shams hopes to finally be reunited with them in Canada next spring.
Yeah, oh, if I don't follow the rule that I set
I miss
up like
you, bro. So well, last time you didn't come to that.
On Friday evenings, Shams and a group of other former refugees, mostly young men who made it to Toronto, gather in Stephen's backyard. Over pizza and drinks, they talk about who will arrive when, where to look for sponsors, how to raise money.
By the way, guys, are you guys following the Instagram?
I hope that one day...
Shams is now studying part-time at the University of Toronto. He hopes to one day become a human rights lawyer.
Every day that I can save somebody, I make up the time that I lost there.
I have no idea how long this is going to continue. I finished the house money last month. I'll have to keep trying to find more money. And if I can't, then I'll have to stop. I mean, I'm finding money where I can. Another friend of mine died and he divided his house among 12 friends. So I will get another $100,000+. And I said to him before he died, you know, I'm going to give it to the Afghans. And he said, and I said, too bad, Ken, you leave it to me. I do with it what I want. So I squared it with him to some degree. And that'll help. But I mean, $100,000 doesn't go very far. That's 10 people.
One thing I want to say to Miriam, that one day one of these pupils that you have helped and that you will help will do exactly what you do. It could be me, it could be somebody else. And that her legacy of helping will live on.
Too many people in the world go around saying no for all sorts of reasons. And to be able to say yes to someone is one of the nicest things in the world, to be able to say to someone, yes, we can help.
An update on this story. A full decade after he fled Afghanistan, a much-anticipated reunion for Shams. His siblings and their families are expected to arrive in Canada as permanent residents in the coming weeks. Today's story was reported and produced by me, Aliza Siegel. A version originally aired on The Current. Special thanks to story editor Liz Hoth. Storylines is produced by AC Rowe. The show is part of the CBC Audio Doc Unit. If you enjoyed today's episode and care about Canadian documentaries, please take a moment to rate and review. Those 5-star reviews help others find us. And do share the podcast with a friend. I'm Aliza Siegel. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.